You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Thanks for all of you guys tuning in to our first 10 episodes so far. If this is your first time, make sure you hit subscribe below if you're watching us on YouTube, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. My guest today is Grace Panetta. She is a journalist at Business Insider who is kind of an election whiz and covers everything related to ballots, post office, election results, court cases, and more. Grace, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, look, so part of the reason I wanted to have you on is one, because you've been in the weeds of this stuff for months and months and months now, and now is your time to shine, finally. But also because I think you play it pretty straight and narrow. I really do. I follow a number of reporters, and I think there's a lot of truth to the argument that the media has a liberal bias, and a lot of reporters are just openly skewed and slanted, but I think you really try to play it fair. So I want us to talk about the question of President Trump refusing to concede the election, and some conservatives and Republicans arguing that it's been stolen with mass fraud and demanding recounts and demanding votes be disqualified. And everybody's heard something about this, but I would really like to kind of break it down for people and just sort fact from fiction, honestly. So just to start, I think one of the most kind of head-scratching parts about it for me is that this was actually a very good election for Republicans. If you looked at the polls beforehand, right, they said that Democrats were going to clean up in the House and the Senate. Well, Republicans basically have probably kept the Senate, depending on the Georgia runoff. They could narrowly lose it. And then in the House, the Republicans did much better than expected, right? And at the state and legislature level, too. So just, is it kind of implausible on its face that this was a rigged election, given how it didn't really go well for Democrats other than Joe Biden winning?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very, very important point, because for a while there's been kind of a conventional wisdom, which has now been complicated a bit, that higher turnout, more people voting, making it easier to vote and having more voting options is automatically going to benefit Democrats. And as we've seen, that's not necessarily the case. And that actually backs up some of the scholarly literature on this, that, you know, just expanding male voting on its own and higher turnout on its own does not necessarily benefit one party over the other. And we really saw that starkly in this election, with Biden doing very well, but Republicans exceeding expectations down the ballot. And it does make it very implausible that this election was rigged, because would Democrats go to all the trouble to rig a presidential election, which is, of course, infeasible and did not happen, and then just forget to rig all the down ballot races, too? That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and in the kind of swing states, maybe you could go through them.
Yeah.
Who actually runs the elections in some of these states? I know that in Georgia and a couple other places, the secretary of states for that state that run the elections are Republicans, right?
Yeah, definitely. In both. So election administration, it varies state by state. It's something that's can be complicated, and it's also very decentralized. So every state has some kind of a chief elections official or authority. In most cases, the secretary of state. In some, it's a bipartisan commission, like Wisconsin and North Carolina have state elections boards or commissions. But then the actual business of really running the election is done by officials at the county level. These are sometimes elected officials, like in Florida, the supervisor of elections is an elected person. Sometimes there are people who are municipal clerks or, you know, other county boards of elections that are selected in other ways. But yeah, the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, he's a Republican. Florida Secretary of State is a Republican. And then, of course, Wisconsin and North Carolina have been just a single partisan official.
So the final margin of victory, according to Real Clear Politics, and I think there's still some different places have different margins or final states to be called, but Biden has 306 electoral votes and Trump has 232. Can you break down what the margin of victory was, not in terms of the popular vote, which doesn't technically count, but in terms of which states kind of determined the result here? And then in these states, what were the margins? Are we talking hundreds of votes, thousands of votes, tens of thousands of votes, or hundreds of thousands of votes?
Yeah, so thinking about the swing states, obviously the ones that were first called on election night, Biden won Wisconsin by over 20,000 votes, which is a pretty big victory. And then even larger victories in places like Michigan, where he won by over 140,000 votes. And Pennsylvania, too, that one was a real squeaker, and that was the state that really pushed Biden over the top. And there, too, the margin of victory now, as more ballots have been counted, is way outside of the threshold for an automatic recount. And Biden's ahead by several tens of thousands of votes there, too. And then he also had pretty, you know, resounding victories well outside of what any recount could flip in Nevada and Arizona. And then, of course, Georgia was the big surprise and was the closest state. Yeah, right now, as I'm looking, Biden has 2.47 million votes and Trump has 2.45 million votes. So it's a difference that's, you know, smaller than some of the other swing states, but still, you know, pretty decisive, pretty, you know, resounding. These are obviously margins of victory for Biden that would be hard or near impossible to reverse through any litigation or recounts.
How many states would Trump have to reverse or overturn in order to swing the electoral vote in his favor?
Oh no, you asked me to do math.
Several states, right?
Yeah, several. Yeah, many, many states. Yeah, because Biden flipped five of the states that Trump won in 2016. So it would definitely have to be states comprising of over 70 electoral college votes, and that would be quite a lot.
And have we had even a single state be flipped before in this manner?
No, we have not. And I mean, obviously, the most recent disputed presidential election in our history was the 2000 election. And that was one where the networks erroneously called Al Gore as the winner of Florida. But of course, he was never actually ahead at any point. The networks quickly retracted their calls on election night. And then throughout the entire recount and the lawsuits and the litigation, it was always, you know, Bush was ahead. It never really flipped. And that's, you know, pretty rare. It can happen more often in like really small or local races where it comes down to just a few hundred or a few dozen ballots, but at the presidential level, no.
Well, and in Bush v. Gore, it was a difference of a few hundred votes that was at stake.
Yeah.
So in order to kind of have a recount or flip an election of tens of thousands of votes in a state, that would be unheard of, right?
Yeah, it would be at the presidential level. I mean, generally in the statewide recounts we've seen, it's really just come down to, you know, usually 1,000 votes is the general benchmark for, you know, when an election could possibly be changed through a recount. But once you get over 1,000, 2,000 votes, the chances of that become more and more remote.
Well, what about, I guess, one point that people who do believe this election could still be changed would say is, well, yeah, but in the past, we've never had mass mail-in voting, right? The coronavirus has changed the way we do elections. And like you said, that increased turnout. And so we've got really high turnout levels. But at the same time, we also have massive amounts of people voting by mail, just mailing in ballots. There's all sorts of kind of question marks surrounding that. So is it possible that having everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people switch to mail-in ballots changes the game and could make it, this time it is possible for such a big margin to be overturned?
Well, what mail voting does is it can often make it longer to know the result of an election. And obviously the leader of a race can change over time as ballots are counted. But it doesn't, you know, necessarily increase the chances that a state will necessarily flip from one side or the other. It's what comes down to really the margin at the end of the day. So like Pennsylvania, for example, was one where they don't allow their officials to begin processing mail ballots prior to election day. And so because of that, the first votes that were recorded were the election day votes. Those went heavily towards Trump. Trump was leading by tens of thousands of votes in Pennsylvania, but then as ballots were counted throughout the next few days, Biden took the lead and is now ahead by a margin that's well outside of the, you know, margin for a recount. So it's not so much that the result flipped, it's just that one candidate led as votes were counted and then another took over the lead. It's not really a flip per se.
Well, and it's funny. One, how dumb is that some states have that rule you can't start counting We all would have known the results earlier if they'd been able to count the mail-in ballots as they came in, as they do in other states, right?
Exactly. And that's something that's so infuriating to many election officials and experts. It's just not a partisan issue. Like letting states, Florida and Arizona and Ohio, all these, and Georgia, all these red states allow their election officials to process ballots prior to election day. And then, you know, the Pennsylvania legislature, the Wisconsin legislature refused to do the same, really for no discernible reason.
And what would they say the reason is?
Well, sometimes people make arguments, oh, well, if you allow officials to process and count before, like the results can be leaked or like improperly released to the public. That's not really a thing that happens. There's no really incentive to do that. And it's never really been an issue in the states that do allow pre-processing and pre-counting. And instead, it's so much easier on the election officials because they have more days and weeks to spread out the work. And it means we have results faster and don't have a situation where one candidate's leading right. And the other isn't.
And I, Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, we all hate yeah. not knowing, yeah. right? We all hate not knowing the result for three yeah. days, 5 days, whatever it was. But I guess one thing that I'll ask about then is they did kind of warn us ahead of time, right? And yes. and I'm very critical of the media and their election coverage, but yeah. they were right. And they warned us and they said we might have a red mirage, right? Yeah. Where you have on election night, it seems like Trump is doing better because the first votes that are counted are in-person votes and Trump voters are more likely to vote in person because he told his yeah. people not to vote by mail. Yep. He specifically said so. Yet a lot of people say we went to bed and Trump was winning. We wake up and in the middle of the night, all of a sudden everything changed. And they view this as a red flag for fraud, or they don't trust. And I listen, as a libertarian, I can see why they wouldn't trust government yeah. officials. but is that really something to be concerned by, the fact that it seemed like Trump was doing so well at first, and then he kind of over time and overnight fell behind.
Well, yeah, it's a little, it also varies by state. And obviously the red mirage scenario played out in some states, not others, again, depending on which states allowed their officials to process ballots before time. So when Florida has extensive pre-processing, it was the opposite, where when votes started to come in right when the poll closed, it showed Biden ahead because those were all the mail votes and many of the early person votes being reported. And then as the election day votes were counted and reported, it was Trump who took the lead. So it really depends state by state. But yeah, and I mean, that is a thing that happened, obviously, in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, where officials had less of an ability to process those ballots prior to, and we saw those, you know, sort of red mirages. But it's, you know, not a reason to distrust the process. I mean, and these are all things that go back to the state legislatures and thinking about trust in government. For many libertarians who are skeptical of the federal government, actually, election administration is run entirely at the state and local level for the most part. So this really comes down to decisions made by officials at, you know, at the most local levels and at the state level. And it's, you know, not a reason to distrust the process or think that anything is wrong or fraudulent. We have 5 states out on the West Coast and Hawaii who run their elections almost entirely by mail. And that has been remarkably successful for them. And so, yeah, you know, having ballots taking a few days to be counted doesn't mean that it's anything's inherently suspect.
Well, and one thing that I found validating was a report that came out of a subcommittee from the Department of Homeland Security, which is part of the Trump administration, right? It's under a Trump administration appointee. And it said the November 3rd election was the most secure in American history. Yep. There is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised. So I guess what I would ask, though, is that there have been instances where people rightly feel that the government, the federal government at the non-political level has been biased against Trump. You look at the FISA court that awarded a warrant to spy on his campaign based on very flimsy evidence. You look at what has been exposed, what people at the FBI were saying about how they didn't like Trump. Should people trust that DHS evaluation?
Yes, they absolutely should. And so the director at little sub-agency, it's not a little sub-agency, it's a very important one, the Center for Infrastructure and Security Agency, or Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, their director, Chris Krebs, is a very, very highly respected cybersecurity official who is held in extremely high regard by people on both sides of the aisle, nonpartisan election officials and experts, you know, all the people, you know, I've spoken to about this issue in the past several months have had nothing but good things to say about him and about him running that agency. And that is definitely a statement that you can trust. And the reason why, too, is like I mentioned, elections are run at the local level, you know, by local officials who are your neighbors, your friends, people in your community. It's not run by the federal government. And as the statement mentions, and this is kind of a point that got lost in all the discussion about mail voting, is from a cybersecurity standpoint, our elections have never been more secure. We have more jurisdictions, more states than ever, either using paper ballots, ballot marking devices, or electronic voting machines with a voter verifiable paper trail than ever before. You know, since the advent of voting machines. And so because of all these paper trails that we have, it's really never been secure.
So one thing I'll ask about, though, is as I've seen kind of scattershot over like far right media and, mm-hmm. and people here and there, they'll find examples where they say dead people have voted or people who are on the voting rolls or sent in ballots that are dead or don't exist or multiple ballots from one person. To what extent are these anecdotes that we've seen true examples, and to what extent are they actually emblematic of a widely existing phenomenon rather than just one-off examples?
Yeah, so it's important to note that when news organizations have examined these lists of supposed dead people voting, what they have found is that in a lot of cases, you know, those lists were not the most accurate. Sometimes it's because of people who share the same name with someone who died or a very similar name. And this is an issue officials run into when they try to do voter list maintenance and remove people who they think might be dead or ineligible from the rolls, is a lot of people have similar names to each other. And, you know, it's also important to note that in several states, if you send in a mail ballot and then pass away or die afterwards, in many states that ballot won't be counted. So that happened in a few cases. But I know, for example, in one case in Georgia, on one of the lists that the Trump campaign or their allies put out of that supposedly had dead people voting, it was one where it was a widow and she had been listed on the voter rolls as Mrs. and then her husband's name, because that's how, you know, a lot of names were listed back in the day for married women. And so she, you know, was a perfectly valid voter, legal voter, cast a legal vote, is alive and well. But because she was listed as Mrs. and then her late husband's name, that sort of got mixed up in the process. And they thought, oh, it's this dead guy voting, when it wasn't her. As far as I've seen, there is no pervasive instance of dead people voting or people casting ballots on behalf of dead voters. Always some one-off instances of that kind of fraud every election, but it's not a systemic issue. And a lot of these big lists that the Trump campaign has released, a lot of names on them, you know, not held up, and there's just no evidence that there's pervasive fraud there.
So you know all about kind of election rules and procedures far better than I. What is to stop me from voting twice? What's to stop me from sending in three mail-in ballots all for Joe Biden?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's important to first note that mail ballots have so many different layers of security and checks and balances throughout the system that we can't even imagine. And a lot of cases, ballots have a specific voter identification number or barcode on them that are specific to that ballot and specific to that voter. And so, for example, if you first request a ballot to vote by mail, you're going to be marked off in the systems that election officials use. Their statewide poll books or voter databases, you'll be marked off as having requested a ballot. And then if you return it, you'll be marked in the database as having returned your ballot. So then you can't, you know, try to vote another time after you've already voted. And then for in-person voting too, a lot of states have a rule where if you request a ballot and then go vote in person, you'll have to vote a provisional ballot that's then only counted if your mail ballot isn't received. And because, you know, election officials have these databases they use within their own states, and then they also share information with other states. And that's how a lot of other cases of double voting are caught.
So because of the way that voting works, there aren't voter ID laws in every state. what is to stop someone like me? Say I voted by mail, but I know what precinct my neighbor, he's the same precinct as me. What's to stop me from showing up at the polls and say, yep, I'm Mr. Bob George, 1602 Smith Street, right? And just voting as him. What's to stop me from doing that?
Yeah, so the reason why voter impersonation is so rare in the first place is it's just a very inefficient way to commit voter fraud. As you mentioned, you have to know the name and address of another registered voter, know for a fact that they're not voting and haven't already voted, because if you show up to the polls and they're marked as having voted, they're not going to let you vote. And even in that case, there, you know, if the poll workers, especially in a small town, have seen that the person's already voted, there might be, you know, they might raise some alarms. So, for example, a good example of this recently that happened in this election was in Pennsylvania, which does not have a voter ID law except for first-time voters. There was a man who voted first on election day and then knew that his son wasn't in town and wasn't going to be voting, put on sunglasses and went back to the polling place and tried to vote again as his son. And the poll worker immediately noticed that that guy looked strangely familiar and stopped him from voting. And he's now facing criminal charges. So yeah, in an ideal world, you know, in order to commit voter impersonation, like everything has to line up. You have to, you know the name, address of another registered voter, look somewhat like them, like not be the same gender. And then, you know, if you're trying to impersonate someone, you have to rely that a poll worker is not going to recognize you. So even if, you know, you can try to do it, even in a state without a voter ID law, it's just very inefficient. And that's why we don't see very high rates of it.
So what about the court cases that are going on? I know the Trump campaign, I guess it would be, not the administration, has taken a bunch of court cases brought them in front of a judge, and they're different things. In some cases, they want a recount. In some cases, they want ballots thrown out. Could you maybe just give us an overview of what these lawsuits are and any outcomes so far?
Yeah, the Trump campaign has, as you mentioned, and filed a lot of lawsuits in a lot of different battleground states. Also the ones where Trump lost or is very behind on a number of different issues, whether a lot of cases have centered around access that poll workers have or poll watchers have been given to the vote counting process or the voting process. In other cases, they've been claiming that ineligible voters cast ballots, but mainly the sort of this issue of poll watchers being given access. And they've not been very successful so far. I believe they've maybe won one court challenge and lost well over a dozen, I think maybe 20 at this point. In many cases, the Trump campaign is often not making these same sweeping arguments that we might see online about massive voter fraud. They're not even claiming that. They're making these other arguments about access to poll watchers. And in many cases, judges have not been buying what they're selling. And, you know, that's why they haven't been very successful in court.
Well, I'm glad you brought up poll watchers, because one thing that's been alleged is that there are instances, I'm thinking particularly in Pennsylvania, where they say they didn't allow poll watchers that from the Trump campaign or the Republicans in, and they couldn't monitor. So because they didn't allow that, therefore, there must have been fraud going on. One, that's kind of a logical leap. But also, is it true that they didn't allow poll watchers in some of these places?
So the short answer is no, and that's why these cases haven't been very successful. Is, for example, in one case about Philadelphia, the Trump campaign, you know, conceded that the poll watchers had been let in, but said that they, you know, weren't allowed to get close enough to see the process. That was their, you know, main complaint. And it's also,
is that valid though?
Yeah, there's, you know, some dispute, obviously, but they did not really succeed in their efforts to get the vote counting stopped or to get those ballots invalidated. Mainly the judges did not find that to be super persuasive. And obviously, you know, it varies. There's, you know, some conflicting poll watchers saying different things about how close they were allowed to get. And it is definitely access is an important part of the process. But this election has also been incredibly transparent. A lot of places have live streamed their vote counting procedures, including Philadelphia. Yeah. And so far, you know, the Trump campaign has not been able to prove that whatever disputes they had about the access to poll watchers meaningfully corrupts the vote counting process.
Yeah, that and it is, I think, kind of telling that the legal results just have not gone their way overwhelmingly. But I will say this. One thing that bothers me is I feel that a lot of journalists in liberal media or liberal, like Democratic politicians and liberal commentators, they'll say things like voter fraud is a myth or voter fraud doesn't exist. Right. And maybe what they mean is that it's not really a wide scale phenomenon. It's not ever going to affect the results, but they sound dismissive. And what happens is to conservative people and Republican voters, they hear that and then they think, well, that's absurd. Of course, it has to exist. So therefore, maybe I should believe what the other people are saying, that it's a rigged election. What do you make of that? Do you think that the way that people talk about this issue is wrong, including on the left?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really important to take fraud when it does happen extremely seriously and not be dismissive and say, oh, it never happens. Because, you know, it is extremely, extremely rare. The decentralization of our system luckily does really disincentivize efforts at fraud, either, you know, voter fraud or efforts to corrupt elections from behind the scenes. But there are, you know, one-off cases. It does happen. If you're going to have a presidential election with over 150 million people voting, there is going to be, you know, some level of fraud or people attempting to commit fraud. So it's not that it's non-existent, but, you know, our systems and state laws are very, very serious about penalizing fraud when they do catch it, because it is an affront to our political system to have someone trying to either commit fraud or even worse, defraud other voters and corrupt their ballots. Which is, for example, what happened a couple years ago in the North Carolina congressional race, where a Republican operative pressured voters improperly into handing over their ballots to volunteers or filling out their ballots in a certain way. That is, you know, really an insult to democracy and to the voters, and it should be taken seriously. So I think there is a middle ground to strike where we can say, yes, you know, the attempts at fraud do occur. It's not non-existent, but it's extremely rare. And there are all these checks and balances in place to catch it when it does happen. And that's how we know of it in the first place.
Well, so there has been, I think, I am frustrated, certainly, by President Trump's refusal to admit that he has not won the election. But I also think there's been an overreaction where people say it's a coup or he's refusing to leave office. I mean, in fairness, Joe Biden is not technically president-elect yet. The votes have not been certified in every single state, and the Electoral College has not voted. And he is right now going through a legal process, taking cases to court and losing. But he hasn't stepped outside of the rules of the game in terms of actual actions, rhetoric aside, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And this is something I'm kind of a perpetual, like, anti-doomsday, like, democracy will prevail type of person. I never really ever believed that there would be a serious coup. And I'm very, very, you know, happy and heartened to see that the system did work as it intended this year. You know, given everything that could have gone wrong, we had a remarkably smooth and peaceful election. And yes, the Trump campaign is battling in court, and there's a lot of very heated rhetoric coming from the president, a lot of misinformation. But as of now, you know, this idea that it's being stolen one way or the other, that, there's kind of a coup is just not substantiated. That's not happening.
Well, President Trump and kind of Republican defenders will say, well, they're just going through the process. So therefore, that's a defense for everything they're doing. But like you said, I mean, they are misleading people, right? And isn't it, we're going to see We're going to see Republican leaning voters or Trump supporters not believe the results of this election. And is that really problematic for the future?
It is. It's a huge, huge long-term problem for our democracy to have people believe that, you know, every election result that their side lost is invalid, or that the system is fundamentally corrupted. Because that is, you know, the irony and the cognitive dissonance is we just had a remarkably successful, well-run election, secure election, you know, despite the pandemic, even in spite of the coronavirus throwing a wrench into everything. And it is definitely a huge issue for people to believe, oh, everything's corrupt or everything's rigged. That could not be further from the truth. You know, our local election officials are just incredibly hardworking. They bend over backwards to make democracy work. And they, you know, should not be the target of any kind of vitriol or sense that the election's rigged. It is a long-term problem for trust in democracy to believe that, you know, the winner wasn't the rightful winner.
But is it a little bit, I think, selective memory for people who, I completely agree with this criticism, that it is problematic for Republicans to be convinced of this, and it's irresponsible for leaders to teach their base that not accept the outcome. But I remember I was born before 2016, and I seem to remember opinion polls showing a fair number of Democrat voters did not believe Donald Trump was actually elected president. A fair number believed that Russia had actually hacked and changed the voting roll, which did not happen. So is this isn't totally new, is it?
No, it's not new. And this has been a feature of our system, you know, since the beginning of our democracy, of one side believing that the election's rigged and spreading that conspiracies irresponsibly, especially since the advent of voting machines. That, you know, every cycle there are conspiracies or misinformation that, oh, the voting machines are hacked. It's all rigged. The Republicans rigged it. And so that's been, those have been around for a while. But yeah, it's absolutely true that a lot of the rhetoric after 2016 is coming from some very high-ranking Democratic officials and politicians was irresponsible in portraying Russia as having stolen the election. Of course, the Russian interference was an attack on our democracy, both in the form of their use of social media and the way that they attempted incursions into our voting systems. But of course, you know, there's no evidence that anything is hacked, no evidence that no votes were changed as far as the election system go. So it definitely, you know, did reach the irresponsible level from the left to from some quarters.
So I, with that, I think we'll kind of wrap up the election talk. So thank you for that. And I really hope that listeners find it helpful. If you want to follow Grace's work, you can check her out on Twitter, and she reports for Business Insider, which I like to read, and I very wide breadth of coverage you guys do at BI. I explained this to you before the show. It is a tradition on my podcast that you must offer up your controversial hot take about food. And because you appeared on my podcast, that's what we do here. Hit us with it, Grace.
So I think when it comes to pasta, and when it comes to certain recipes that call for like only, you know, whole tomatoes or like fresh tomatoes, it's really okay to use sauce that comes from a can or a jar. You don't need to use like perfect whole tomatoes and like crush them with your hands, even though that might horrify some people. It's okay to use it from a sauce, from a can or a jar. Just put some pasta water in there. Like, I promise the Italian ancestors will not come down and smite.
So because you're from Massachusetts, just like me, I also have to ask you, Dunkin' or Starbucks?
Oh, Dunkin', always. Always Dunkin'.
So maybe I'm a heretic as a Massachusetts person, but now that I've moved to D.C. and I really don't drink Dunkin' as much, when I drink it, it tastes really watered down and weak.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I definitely, their hot coffee, I have not been impressed with. But their iced coffee, I think, is much better.
Drink iced, so.
Yeah, I would say. And Starbucks, it can be fun sometimes. But I feel like a lot of all their coffee is just like burnt, and that they build off of that.
All right. But. Well, Grace, thank you so much. Everybody, you can check her out on Twitter, Grace Panetta, PANETTA. Grace, thank you. And everybody, we will be back next week. If you like this show, make sure you're subscribed down below on YouTube, or you're following us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you are really a stan. That's how you show your love. All right, everybody, we'll talk again next week.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.